I'm Bill Barol. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 11, Super Auto. Dear Bill, so far in these podcasts, we've worked under the assumption that creativity is basically a good thing. But of course, that's not true. It is whatever you want it to be, and that's not always positive. After all, what else is a lie but creativity? What else is a con artist but someone using creativity to fabricate a reason for you to part with your money? Companies like Facebook and Google have on their staff legions of bright creative thinkers, all focused on the dark mission of finding more imaginative ways to monetize your secrets. And it's not like they just ask you for them. They use creativity to make you want to tell them. Academics have a name for this. They call it dark creativity, which is pleasantly dramatic, but I'm not sure we need to distinguish. It's all just creativity. Creativity is a tool, and just like all tools, it doesn't have its own moral compass. It can be good or bad depending on who's using it. A hammer is a tool, and we don't call it a hammer when it builds a house, but a dark hammer when it caves in a skull. It's the same hammer. The morality lies in the owner, and people are imperfect. Much of the research into this correlates with what they call EI, emotional intelligence. Apparently, and I have no earthly idea how they test for emotional intelligence, but people who are creative but also low in EI are, it seems, more likely to employ dark creativity, which all sounds like a very complicated and probably expensive way to say that bad people do bad things, which my considered response would be, no duh. There are whole industries focused on this villainous use of creativity. In fact, I'd be willing to bet that more people make their money out of that than earn a crust from the romantic, artistic end of things that we've been talking about in all of our previous episodes. I mean, are you aware of the concept of advertising? Artistic titans using a mastery of prose, imagery, music, psychology, and 12 dozen other swathes of the arts and sciences to create the world's most culturally dominant media and make you buy this version of a thing rather than that version. The grunt of all this creativity sits behind the sharp point of influence. Not just to make you do a thing, but to make you want to do a thing. That's the real dark creativity here. Just like any good artist understands their audience, understands what will connect with them, what they'll like, how they'll feel seen, understood, spoken to. That nice feeling when you see a piece of culture that seems to speak just to you is using the same blueprint that makes people buy things that are bad for them, vote for the people who will hurt them. The hammer is the same. And it's certainly interesting to delve a little deeper into some of the more nefarious uses of this thing we've been singing the praises of. So let's do that. But if we're talking about dark creativity, then I have one more question for you, Bill. Why is creativity seen as a good thing in the first place? I hope your moral compass is still correctly magnetized. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I'll get to dark creativity in a second. But first, in the spirit of showing how the sausage gets made, we should tell people that this is actually our second attempt at episode 11. The first was, well, a dead end. A dry hole. That's two cliches in a row, but you get the idea. Part of creativity is knowing when you're chasing your own tail. That's three cliches. So after floundering around for a while, we decided to abandon that topic and go instead with this one. My only regret is that you let off that first swing with a fabulously overcooked metaphor about rivers and ponds, which I felt obliged to pick up in turn, and I ended up having way too good a time with it, eventually arriving at a place where I'd worked up a lather about how mediocre ponds are, calling them, and I quote, "no good brackish bastards." Sometimes you have the most fun in the service of the worst ideas. I'm not abandoning hope that we may be able to shoehorn the rivers and ponds thing into a future episode, because as a creative person, you learn not to waste good material if you can help it. But for now, moving on. Let me tackle your big final question first. Creativity is widely held to be good because it's impossible to imagine a life, a world, without it. And here's how I know that. Let's do a thought experiment. Do this for me. Try. Go ahead. Try to imagine a world in which creativity somehow fails to exist. I'll wait. Okay, I'm back. Could you do it? Of course you couldn't. Here's something to break your brain. Simply to imagine a world without creativity would itself require creativity. Any act of imagination of that size would. And make no mistake, that one's a whopper. We're talking about a world with no music, no painting, sculpture, architecture, cuisine, dance, literature. A world with no variety arts. With no juggling. Do I have your attention yet? Creativity is seen to be a good thing for the reason that oxygen is seen to be a good thing. Because it's necessary. We need it to live. So, we're biased. Our brains are tilted to see creativity as good. But that doesn't mean that every purpose to which our innate human creativity gets applied necessarily gets to enjoy society's stamp of approval. And yes, here we run up against the concept of dark creativity, which is, as a piece of taxonomy, pretty problematic. I mean, it's troubling on its face because one person's darkness is another one's light. I'd be willing to bet that those smart social engineers at Google and Facebook could do a good job of justifying their work as something good or at least value neutral. They'd be offended, I bet, at the notion that what they do is a dark art. It all depends on whose ox is being gored, doesn't it? Let me posit this. In the way that history is written by the winners, the kind of value judgment that says one kind of creativity is good while another is bad gets to be made by those at the center of the culture, like, in this case, psychologists. Con men, criminals, and sociopaths get exiled to the edges of the narrative, which in a way denies them their due. We can admire the ingenuity of a well-conceived and flawlessly executed con if we're watching The Sting for the millionth time. But if it was your real-life bankroll that got lifted out of your actual pocket, it wouldn't be quite so entertaining. You'd also be less charmed by some sweaty geek in a cheap suit than you would by 1970s Redford and Newman in suits designed by Edith Head, but come on, who wouldn't? Then there's magic. Magic, as you've pointed out in this podcast, is premised on a lie, and lying is almost universally held to be bad. That doesn't stop us from paying top dollar to go see Penn and Teller in Las Vegas. Ponds are no good brackish bastards if you're on the shore, but they're home if you're a paramecium, and sorry, too soon. You bring up the idea of influence, of not only getting people to do what you want them to do, but of getting them to want to do what you want them to do. And this is an interesting one. I'd argue that influence, even when we consider it to be dark or antisocial, is a higher order thing than brute force, because force lacks subtlety. Influence is all subtlety. It's finding the tiny handholds in a sheer rock face, working your fingers in, and securing a grip. However, here's a question for you. What do we do with influencers? I mean the social media kind, speaking of paramecium. I'm willing to argue we should broadly reframe the dialogue around so-called dark creativity to advance a case that creativity is, as a human thing, value neutral. But then you have 14-year-olds on TikTok making $6 million bucks a year pushing energy drinks, and doing it with none of the wit or artistry that even conventional advertising can muster at its best. My argument kind of falls apart right there. What do you think? I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, as if I haven't considered a world without juggling. As if I haven't, when whimsy strikes, let the fancy take me to musing on the infinite possibilities of what could be, what might have been. Of me working, perchance, in a hat shop, to be cured from this malady of attention-seeking, sweaty desperation. I am so sorry I seem to have become poetically carried away there. I have a slight hangover. But yeah, it is, of course, completely impossible to imagine a world without creativity, as the act of imagining anything requires creativity. Creativity is just a $2 word for making something, anything. Making an idea, making an opinion, making a pie, making a mess, trouble, shoes, bombs. I guess all the kinds of thoughts that aren't based entirely in logic or maths. Sorry, you're American. Math. But even maths can be used creatively, for good and for bad, which brings us back to those people at Google and Facebook. I wonder if you're right about them. As they construct ever more devious ways to discover, categorize, and sell every last minute detail of our daily lives, I wonder if they do, deep down, think they're doing good for the world. Or perhaps, for a few of them, they occasionally wonder why they get paid so well, why there are such great snacks at work, why they get those free massages, and then they probably come to the inevitable conclusion that it's because they're the baddies. Creativity is value neutral, as you say, but people are not. And I think history would tell us that a lot of people are happy to use a little dark creativity if they get sufficiently rewarded for it. An awful lot of people. An awful lot of awful people. People who think of themselves as creative like to be creating. They like to be moving forward, flowing like a river rather than standing, stagnating like a pond. And the thing is, on a spring morning... No, sorry, I really couldn't go anywhere with that. I really tried. Magic is based in lies, that's true, but they're honest lies. That's the fun unspoken contract between a magician and their audience. You know you're being lied to, and the magician will be honest about the fact that they're tricking you. Usually. Uri Geller broke that rule. He pretended that the fairly elementary sleight of hand and misdirection that he uses to bend spoons were real superhuman abilities. He lied about his lies. He used his creativity to be dishonest with everyone and ended up being paid by idiot oil companies to magically tell them where to drill. Well, according to him, but he's a liar. As for con tricks, I do have a slight admiration for a good con. At their best, they're a kind of theatre, dependent on script, characters, scene setting, except the audience don't know they're watching a show. They say that a con only works if it successfully appeals to the victim's greed or vanity. That's a nice way of absolving responsibility. It's sort of like saying, I'm just going to throw punches in the air and walk forwards with my eyes closed, and well, if you happen to get in the way, that's hardly my fault. Cons work because lies work. And lies work because the only way for them not to is for everyone to go through life assuming everything they get told isn't true, and that's a fast way to have a society break down completely. And talking of society breaking down completely, you mentioned social media influencers. The term influencer is, to my mind, in itself a con trick. It pretends to be something new, something that had to be freshly defined because of the new media in which it lives. It pretends to be something complicated, a synergist leveraging of the trust gained from the fake authenticity social media is so good at showcasing, analytic-backed nuanced relationship monetization. But it's nothing new. It's just advertising again. People happy to get paid for pretending to like one thing more than another thing. It's just I Love Lucy brought to you by Philip Morris Cigarettes. They just found an even more objectionable word to describe it. Which is a shame, but an inevitable one, I suppose. Creativity is value neutral. People are not. I am sitting, as per usual, in my comfy chair by the window. I have invested a tiny amount of money on a bird feeder, which attaches to the other side of my window with suckers, and as a result of this, I have developed a submissive relationship with 3 pigeons, 2 sparrows, and 1 blue tit, who visit, by which I mean that if I forget to refill the seeds, they, the pigeons particularly, flap angrily against the window, peck at the empty feeder and give me the stink eye until I pour them out some more food. Oh, and I'd be happy to show you how to bend a spoon in an apparently magical way, because screw that guy. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt. Okay, I'll see your scene setter, as we call it in journalism, and I'll raise you. To wit, I'm sitting at my desk on a sunny Friday, listening to the background sounds of a New York coffee shop, which is what I listen to when I engage my distraction-blocking software. It's called Freedom, by the way, and it's excellent. That's an unsolicited testimonial, although if they wanted to sponsor a nice podcast about creativity, well, the email contact form on the website works. And before me is a double espresso. And I'm marveling at the technology that enables us to have fairly decent espresso in our homes. As you know, being an espresso guy yourself, making a good one is a dance, a cascading series of calculations about beans and grind and tamping pressure and water temperature and extraction time. And any single one of those calculations can, if made poorly, result in an undrinkable sludge. People take years to master the steps of this dance. And yet, here I sit in my home office, a non-barista, with the results of that superbly complex process glistening darkly before me. How did I achieve this? I cheated. I own a super auto espresso machine, which dispenses a delicious cup literally at the touch of a button, handling everything, the grind, the tamp, the temperature, the extraction time, without me. All I do is dump beans in at the top and fill the reservoir with water. My espresso machine is a marvel of culinary technology and a ridiculous extravagance that I have never regretted since the day I decided I didn't want to spend my life mastering the million tiny intricacies of a process that is exquisitely sensitive to multiple failure points. I just wanted the coffee. Making an espresso, however you decide to do so, is creative. Because, as you point out, everything is creative, for good or ill. So let's circle back to those social engineers at Google and Facebook, who seem to be our designated straw people for this argument. Sorry, kids. You asked rhetorically if deep down they don't maybe think they're doing good for the world. Respectfully, because you know I respect you, I wouldn't want you to think otherwise, wow, I think that double espresso is starting to hit. Respectfully, that's not the hypothetical I posed. What I suggested was that they can probably justify the things they do as good or at least value neutral. Sincere belief and self-justification, not the same things. One's a way of life, the other is a survival mechanism. I like my way of thinking about this better than yours, because mine allows for a vestigial shred of underlying humanity, whereas yours just suggests delusion. I guess I'm just a less cynical person than you are, which is, as cynical evasions of accountability go, only slightly less spectacular than saying you're going to windmill punches into the air and if people run into them with their jaws, well, that's their fault. Oh, I also enjoy the one, favored by awful people, that says to the ones they've wronged, "I'm sorry you feel that way." That's good blame shifting. You also speculate about whether our strawman social engineers ever come to the uncomfortable conclusion that they get free unlimited ping pong time and Milano cookies at work, because after all, they're the bad guys, like those anonymous jumpsuited minions who work for Bond villains in their hollowed out volcanoes. Sorry, I can't go with you on this one either. The whole premise of Work 2.0 was that everybody deserved an unconscionable level of work perks. And that's one of the reasons why Work 2.0 was an insupportable house of cards that collapsed when the dawn came. The dawn, in this case, being a pandemic that shuttered offices all over the world. Cons are interesting, and I share your affection for them. But I wonder what it says about the creativity required to execute a successful con, when the most successful con of recent years, of course, I'm referring to the one that positioned a dumb, thuggish, inch-deep rich guy as the protector of an economically aggrieved working class. What does it say about creativity that this con was such a uniquely lazy and terrible one? I mean, the Trump con is, by any reasonable standard, just an absolutely shitty con. It lacks any shred of wit, of grace, of style. You might have seen those email solicitations that get sent out by the wormy class of political wannabes grifting in Trump's wake, the whinging, vaguely truculent ones that say something like, "If you don't send $45 right now, we'll be forced to tell Trump that you don't stand with him." It takes a special kind of dumbass to think people will fall for a threat like that. But I guess people do, or this wouldn't continue to be a viable tactic. And what does it say about the people who do fall for it? It's one thing to get suckered by the sting, and quite another to get taken in by the sting, too. It's the delta between Paul Newman and Robert Redford and Jackie Gleason and Mac Davis. It's felt increasingly over the last 6 years that we're living in a Gleason and Davis world. I'll admit that's not the thought I started out wanting to leave you with, but here we are. And at this point, my pulse is hammering like castanets, and I'm starting to see little sparkles before my eyes. So I'm going to go research things I can do to get an unsustainable level of caffeine out of my bloodstream before the stroke hits. And assuming I can do that, I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill. Oh, you want to go hard with the scene setting? All right then. I am sitting in my comfy chair by the window with a tepid chamomile tea bag pressed snugly into my left eye socket. I have some kind of minor infection in my eyelid, which is causing me to look even more world-weary than usual, and my wife, who somehow knows about these things, has been suggesting that I push tea bags into my eyes to soothe the swelling. I am 72% convinced that she's just doing this for shits and giggles, but it's quite calming, so it's win-win for everyone. I don't even drink tea. I, too, am sitting here with a double espresso or una caffè doppio grazie, as those of us who have been to Italy recently and wish they were still there might say. I don't have an automatic machine like you do. I'm not completely neck-deep in the world of varying roasts, grind settings, distributions, temp pressure, etc., but I am far enough down the rabbit hole that at a gig last weekend, the venue manager gave me some beans that he roasted himself because he wanted my opinion on them, which made me inordinately happy. The process to getting a good espresso shot can be complicated, but I kinda like the faffing. Is faffing a word you have in the States? Feels like it might not be. It also feels like one of those words that even if you don't know what it means, you can kinda guess what it means by how it sounds. Anyway, I like the faffing. The minuscule changes to dozens of variables that end up with the little stolen china cup I have on my windowsill filled with a thick, soft, gloopy collection of notes of licorice, caramel, and tobacco. Maybe pouring a good shot means more because I have deliberately made it more difficult, so it feels like more of an achievement, rather than just wasting time when I really should be writing and recording this. I bet those Google and Facebook people get good espresso for free at work. And if it's not good, well, nobody's going to say anything about it for fear of being fired for not being a team player.
We have sort of a problem here. Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
Can they justify doing what they do? Yes, justifying stuff to yourself is easy. Especially in a workplace culture like Google. Hey, people must love what we do. Look at how much money we make. If people didn't like it, they'd go somewhere else. You don't like us reading your emails? Well, I'm sorry, buddy, but the office ball pit, Stevie Wonder Wednesday, when Stevie Wonder comes in and sings for us during lunch, would say you're in the minority. People clearly love us. I should point out that Stevie Wonder Wednesday is not, as far as I know, a real thing, but it probably is. It's tempting to think that the best, most effective con tricks are elegantly constructed, incredibly clever ones, but the truth is, the cons that work the best are the cons that have been tried and tested. The ones that are easy to pull. And often, those are startlingly simple. My favourite of these is the security guard ATM trick. Get a security guard outfit and one of those silver briefcases. Then print out a sign with the bank logo on it saying the ATM is broken and customers making deposits should give their cash to the security guard. When they do, put it in an envelope and then give them a receipt. It's the receipt that sells it. That's the convincer. You'll have a line of people waiting to give you their cash. A line of idiots. Talking of which, the Trump con is just the same. Simple, tried and tested, and it works on the dumb and the desperate. It's the one that's always used by, to quote Stephen Sondheim, imitation Hitlers but with littler charm. The rich person tells the poor person that the reason they're poor isn't because the rich person has more money. No, of course not. It's because of the outsiders, the people who are different. Stir up hate from one section of poor people towards another section of poor people and watch the votes roll in. Create a war and say you're the only general. Like I said last time, a con works on the greed and vanity of its victim. If I vote for the guy who hates the same people I do, then we can crush them and be rich and powerful together. As if rich, powerful people get that way by helping more people get rich and powerful. That's really not how that works. And it's easy to say that Trump voters were just easily led fools, having their intolerant opinions validated and encouraged by a doughy, dim, fake fascist billionaire who just wanted attention, but no, I got nothing to add there. Oh, except that if any Googlers, Facebookers, or Trumpers are annoyed or offended by what I've been saying about you, well then, I'm sorry you feel that way. Right, time to put that tea bag back in my eye socket, like a normal person does. Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, yes, faffing, as in faffing around, or faffing about, I suppose you'd say over there, because you're English and English people are fancy. I am familiar with the term. Before you get too impressed with my erudition, though, you should understand how I became acquainted with the word, which was in the cheapest possible way. Aaron Sorkin had Josh Lyman use it in an episode of The West Wing. And then, if I remember correctly, had Lyman continue using it for a while in a sort of escalating fashion, one of those Josh Lyman tizzies that made you wonder how a guy who was so operatically neurotic was able to get within 6 feet of the Oval Office. The use of the word faffing was designed, I'd guess, to make the Josh character look adorable. But my guess is it was really there, as most of Sorkin's devices are, to point out how clever Sorkin is. Which he is, I guess. But man, if you want to talk clever, let's talk about Stephen Sondheim rhyming Hitler and Littler. That's a good day's work. You write that lyric, you just got to clock out early. I get what you're saying about dumb, dead simple cons, and how they're frequently more effective than elegantly constructed jewel box cons. I wonder, though, how often the latter even exist in the real world. They seem like something that would be much more a creation of the fictional world, the classic example again being the sting. Reduced to fewer moves, the jewel box con is also well suited to your home turf on the variety stage. After all, what's a good magic show but a con? Even parts of your own non-magic act qualify as a short con, the way you build to your big trick and then casually top it, for example. The fact that people like getting played in this way, even seek it out, and pay good money for the privilege, is further proof that when it comes to what those psychologists call dark creativity, context is everything. When we watch The Sting, or find ourselves being drawn inevitably through the ratcheting series of moves that animate the heist in a great heist movie like Rififi, we're admiring the ingenuity of the screenwriter while we're freed from any moral qualms that might accrue to the real thing. Because it's just a movie, right? That distancing is, I think, the key to thinking about dark creativity. The social engineers we've been talking about, the pickpockets who mine our online lives for saleable data, well, they have self-justification to protect them. And as consumers of dark creativity, for entertainment purposes, we have that old saw to fall back on. It's just a story. Maybe the reason we love this kind of safe, carefully prescribed thrill is that the real thing is upsetting on a deep human level. A level we hesitate to access. When that universal impulse toward creativity we talked about at the start of this episode, and at more depth in season one, when that bone-deep human urge to make something is twisted toward dark ends, it threatens our basic equilibrium. It suggests entropy and chaos, centers that cannot hold, to steal from Yeats. So we turn toward cons, toward stage magic, for the same reason that we gravitate toward horror movies. As a way of apprehending something we fear and abhor from behind a thick layer of safety glass, where it might startle us, even upset us. But it can't hurt us. Hey, before I go, I've started getting targeted ads for Espresso and a multi-part online documentary series called Why Google and Facebook Are Awesome and Would Never Ever Hurt You, Bill. You don't know anything about that, do you? I'll talk to you next time. Bill. Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barol in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barol. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.